This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Sifton, had only recently returned to New York from Afghanistan when the World Trade Center was attacked. Sifton is a human rights lawyer who spent the past year in Afghanistan and Pakistan doing humanitarian aid work. In yesterday's New York Times Magazine, he shared some of his impressions of Afghanistan and some of the cultural paradoxes he witnessed, such as donkey carts carrying computer equipment and hungry children digging through garbage piles using shovels from a Mickey and Minnie Mouse sandcastle set. Earlier today, I asked Sifton what it was like being a human rights lawyer in Afghanistan, where the law is very restrictive, harsh, and punitive.
It's very interesting because in law school, which was very recent for me, we often would have many discussions about how international human rights law, in a sense, didn't exist. It was a kind of cliche conversation that we had regularly. And then to be in Kosovo in 1999 and then later here in Afghanistan in 2001, I really saw the reality of that sentiment. Human rights is a kind of a myth that you believe in, like somebody might believe in God, really. I mean, it's a myth, and we have to sort of believe in the face of contrary phenomena that there may really actually be a universal set of human rights, things like that. It's very difficult.
Describe some of the laws that struck you as the most anti-human rights laws, the most harsh and punitive.
Surely the worst violation of human rights are suffered by women. The prohibitions against females working are just simply devastating. Women have nothing to do. They sit in their homes, unable to go outside, usually without a male escort or a family escort. They become often depressed and even suicidal as the result of this just complete prohibition on life activity. So that to me is the worst. I mean, the fact that the country is in ruins and that there's systematic violations of social and economic rights as well as political and civil rights is, of course, bad, and the totality of that is probably the worst human rights violation of all. But if I was asked to name one, it would have to be the prohibition against female employment.
What were some of the laws you had to follow that were just so unimaginable to you, you know, to live under that kind of system?
International staff rarely were subjected to the day-to-day street law that most of the people of Afghanistan had to live under. For instance, I did not need to grow a beard. The Taliban treat expatriate staff with an extraordinary amount of respect. And, of course, it may seem absurd to everybody listening to say something good about the Taliban, but I have to say it in all honesty that the Taliban leadership was often very, very cooperative with UN and international staff, something that they rarely were thanked for, and which probably contributed to their anger and bitterness towards the West, which has been manifested many ways in the past. The laws that we had to live under were quite simple. We were asked not to drink in public, not to play music, not to be seen with Afghan women, for instance, in a car, not to have any relationships with Afghan women, or if you were an Afghan woman, not to have a relationship with an Afghan male. But essentially, other than that, we were free to go about our business as humanitarian aid workers in the best way we could.
Now, you mentioned in your article in the New York Times that you saw enemies of the Taliban hanging from lampposts, hanging from cable on lampposts. Was that a common sight?
No, not a common sight, but a sight to be seen at times.
How would the Taliban leadership decide who gets hung from a lamppost and who gets another form of punishment?
I think the thing to understand about the Taliban leadership is that they're not a monolithic structure. They're not a organized leadership structure in the way that we're probably used to in the West. What you have in Afghanistan, as in many places of the world, is a sort of loose-knit band of allegiances between local leaders and military commanders and municipal leaders that is probably more complex than could ever be unraveled by any anthropologist or political scientist. I mean, it would be, it's a maze of political allegiances and intrigue. And when you see something, anything, from a building being built to a building being destroyed or a person being arrested or a person being freed from prison, when any political phenomenon is highly complex, there are things at work that are outside the Taliban and inside the Taliban. What I mean by all that is when you see something like an execution, it could be real, it could be a criminal being punished for a crime, or it could be purely a political execution for the sake of political gain on the part of certain political actors. So it's never really possible to know what you're looking at. And that was often something that I found difficult in Afghanistan.
Would you have any way of estimating how much popular support the Taliban had among the people who you met? I mean, did most people you meet seem to support them beyond just like the lip service you might give just out of self-protection?
It went more than lip service. In many cases, there were people who had to work with the Taliban and understood that cooperation was necessary just for day-to-day existence. Again, important to remember that the Taliban on the local level were often just ordinary municipal leaders, many of whom perhaps did not share the ideology of the Taliban movement. But people were often angry about things, refused to talk about them because of obvious repercussions that could have. So you didn't hear many bad things about the Taliban. What you got were a lot of silences. You'd ask a question about what it was like, and people just would not answer.
Now, what about the Taliban religious police? These are the people who have to enforce all the codes, like making sure that men have a beard, and what other things do they ride down the street enforcing?
Well, the Western press has keyed in on these groups, the committees to promote virtue and prohibit vice, or vice and virtue, as we called them. You don't see them that often. In Kabul, they were more common. And outside of Kabul, in rural areas, they were very rare to see, and in some places, non-existent. But when you do see them, essentially, they were looking to see whether people were dressed correctly and whether their beards were the correct length. But strangely enough, oftentimes it was more of a joke than a reality, as jokes were made by people about how long their beards would be, were they long enough. But I got the feeling that when we expatriates, when we international staff weren't around, that it was a different story, that perhaps everybody behaved differently, that there were more police when we weren't around. I mean, that when we were around, they sort of did not do their job with the full vigor that they did at other times.
My guest, John Sifton, is a human rights lawyer who spent the past year in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Sifton, a human rights lawyer who spent the past year doing humanitarian aid work in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Well, what are some of the typical questions you were asked about the United States?
Well, in answering that, I should probably say that the association between the Taliban and the people themselves of Afghanistan is actually pretty tenuous. Many people on the street don't really support the Taliban, don't share their ideology, and don't hate the West. So the questions that would be asked by ordinary Afghans were often the same as the Taliban, but oftentimes they showed a more more of the fascination, less of the negativity. People would ask about how big the country was, how far it was from certain places, how far it was from Saudi Arabia, from Mecca, how far it was from Pakistan. Somebody asked me about Hollywood, which they thought was a company, not a place, but essentially they had it right.
You quote also somebody asking you about New York when they found out you were from New York. They said to you something like, "This is a place with many black people from Africa. Is this right? Very dangerous. The black people are very dangerous. I hear that they are very tall. How tall are they?" And I thought, this is, where does this come from?
Well, perhaps most Afghans have never even laid eyes on somebody of African descent, except for perhaps a UN worker. Well, there were some African UN workers, indeed, and African-American aid workers. But I don't think I can even imagine myself what it's like to have never seen somebody from Japan and somebody from Africa, and just to have a sort of curiosity that they're different, that they must look different, and you've probably heard that they're different. It's difficult for me to imagine, but I can imagine at least that the fascination must be very acute.
Did you try to explain to people what America's really like, or explain what New York is like, or what the people in New York are like?
Yes. There were many friends I made, local Afghans. We'd have discussions about New York. I essentially told them that New York was a multicultural place, a place where people took the train together to work, and the train would be Russians and Afghans and Pakistanis and Chinese and Korean, African-American, West Indian people all together on the train. I picked that description because I thought it summed up something about New York, which is very important to me, at least. I often get the sense, though, that it just seemed somehow like a zoo to the people I was talking to. I think they may have thought that it just sounded insane, like a place where anything could happen at any time.
Well, the whole idea of diversity or difference seems so alien to them.
yes and no. Afghanistan is a very diverse place.
Is it?
Ethnically. Uh-huh. There are many different ethnicities. There were, and still are in some places, many different languages. And there's a collision between many different cultures, the Persian culture from West Iran, and then this Asian culture from Pakistan and India next door, even Chinese, Tibetan culture sort of creeping in, and then a sort of remnants of even Greek times, millennia ago. There's still Greek touches in architecture, and Genghis Khan invaded too, and the Russian Soviet architecture. It's such a mix of all these different cultures and peoples and languages all pressing down on this landlocked country.
I want to read something from your New York Times Magazine article that was published yesterday, and this is an excerpt of your description of how the Taliban troops look. And you write, "A colleague told me when I first arrived, the Taliban troops are like gangsters, tough guys." And then you say, "But there's often a particular dandyism in them. Many wear black eyeliner, and their hair is long and curly. I once saw one buying Prel shampoo at the bazaar. They carry themselves like supermodels. The reputation for religious conservatism in the Taliban obviously doesn't come from their foppish troops." In what ways do the troops seem like dandies?
Well, it's a cheap shot, and I wish that I could have explained more. They look like supermodels, but they're not. dandies. They're very, very tough soldiers who have often fought in unbelievable circumstances in the north, in the mountains. The eyeliner is not cosmetic so much as actually practical. It protects the eyes from the dust. It's called Kohl, spelled with an H. But all that being as it is, it still is the case that there is something sort of theatrical about it all. They carry themselves as though they're entering a stage in a play. They have very good posture often. They are often tall, and it is an impressive sight. We see dandyism, but I think there's a good question to ask when just culturally. That just may be us. I mean, we see something there. We see this phenomena that I can write about in the New York Times Magazine, which incidentally has its fashion supplement in the back filled with pictures of male models and things like that. But I don't know what an Afghan sees. Maybe an Afghan just sees a Talib dressed as one of the descendants of Muhammad carrying a rifle. Maybe he doesn't see any of what I saw. That may very well be the case.
I appreciate what you're saying, that it's all in the eye of the beholder. I was wondering, reading your article, whether many people in Afghanistan had seen movies that they were perhaps trying to emulate in their bearing or in the way they carried themselves in their clothing or whatever. But then I was thinking, well, what are the odds of that, since there aren't exactly a lot of movie theaters right now in Afghanistan? I mean, you can't even play music in public.
Well, there are, even if there are no movies, there are a lot of movie posters. I said Titanic was a big phenomenon there. A bunch of articles, I think, in newspapers were reporting that children or teenagers were trying to get haircuts in the style of Leonardo DiCaprio in that movie. On a day-to-day basis, though, you just saw a lot of ordinary people going about their business, doctors, farmers, and they were not really trying, like so many people do in America, to sort of affect an image. And perhaps the only place you did see that was in cities, in rural areas, of course. You have people who have probably never even seen a representation of a living being. They have never seen a picture, a photograph even, let alone a movie. So obviously you don't see that sort of thing in those areas.
Did the Taliban ever try to convert you to their brand of Islam?
Well, I'll say this. You know, my interaction with the Taliban was not the commonality of my existence in Afghanistan. I was often with my colleagues and my coworkers, my friends. The Taliban was somebody I saw occasionally for meetings, for permission to do things like that. Conversion was not top on the list of their needs and desires for me. I mean, usually it was humanitarian action was needed in some place and we would work together on something. The people who did talk to me about Islam were usually my friends, and there wasn't so much an effort to convert me as just an effort to discuss Islam and its relationship with Christianity and the differences and the similarities. And those conversations were quite common, but not with the Taliban, just with other Afghans.
I don't know how religious you are, but if you consider yourself pretty secular, is that something that you would feel comfortable expressing or that you feel would even be comprehended?
Actually, strange as it may sound, it's probably more offensive to say you don't believe in God there than to say you're a Christian, because at least if you're a Christian, you are, as they say, a person, man of the book, and you share the same lineage, Moses and Jesus, and then for them, Muhammad. But I never said to anybody I was an atheist. I often didn't answer questions about specifics, or I answered them in vague ways, as in the article when I just said I was basically a Christian. And that was probably the best way to go, I think. It didn't offend anybody, or at least I hope not.
John Sifton is a human rights lawyer who spent the past year doing humanitarian aid work in Pakistan and Afghanistan. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Sifton, a human rights lawyer who spent the past year in Afghanistan and Pakistan doing humanitarian aid work. In yesterday's New York Times Magazine, he wrote about some of the cultural paradoxes he witnessed in Afghanistan, a country that is at once pre-modern and post-modern. Sifton returned to New York shortly before the attacks on the World Trade Center. You write in your Times article that after you'd gotten back to New York and then the World Trade Center was attacked, you felt that you had not escaped Afghanistan, that you had brought its disaster home with you to New York. Could you talk a little bit about what it was like to experience this violence and this kind of massacre in your own home?
It's not so much the violence, because actually as an aid worker, I didn't see violence in Afghanistan. What I saw was the effects of violence. Fleeing, people becoming refugees, living in areas without adequate food or sanitation facilities or water sources, and seeing people basically dying, people lying in tents, sort of waiting to die. And you walk through these camps filled with these people, and you go into a low-level shock in a way, no matter how many times you've done it. And that's what I felt I'd brought home, not the violence as much as just the visual representation that many people right near you were dying, preventable death. And that was the shock that I felt I'd brought home, or the disaster I'd brought home. In our culture here in America, death is really shielded. Hospitals have closed doors and curtains, and you see very little death in America, and very few dead bodies and things like that. But on September 11th, I think we were confronted with a very upfront, close image of it, and I think it probably changed a lot of people. It changed my view of America, even though I had already seen quite similar amounts of destruction.
Now, you not only worked in Afghanistan during this past year, you worked in Pakistan as well. Were you working mostly with Afghan refugees who fled across the border?
Yes. Most of the aid organizations on the border were working with a substantial caseload left over from the Soviet invasion and the Civil War days. There were also new arrivals coming from the drought. This is the area where a lot of new refugees are arriving now in the wake of the September 11th bombings. But it's important to realize that most of the refugees are probably in better shape than the people who are stuck within Afghanistan without the capacity to even get out of the country. And that's an interesting thing to think about. As most of the aid is now going not towards Afghanistan itself, but rather to the border areas.
What's your motivation for doing humanitarian work?
In law school, I found it sort of distant. It being human rights, I found human rights kind of distant from the realities that were on the ground for most of the world's people. Human rights is often practiced by lawyers in European countries, the United States. We put together organizations that advocate for human rights. But the truth of the matter is that on the ground, where people are really dealing with the hunger and the repression that makes their lives so miserable, the human rights groups aren't really there. They're in New York raising money at a benefit, things like that. That's not true. There are many, many brave, it's not true in one sense. There are many, many brave human rights lawyers all over the world working right on the ground. But I felt as though, sort of at my level, that I was distant, and I wanted to get a closer picture of the situation on the ground. And I felt working in a humanitarian aid organization was something that allowed that. And I'm confident that I did get a better picture, but whether I was just indulging myself, I don't know.
Why do you doubt that you have accomplished something important?
Well, it's a very strange world, humanitarian aid. Many people whose motives are not as pure as I think a lot of people would expect. A lot of people are what a friend of mine used to call disaster tourists. I think people who get a sort of thrill out of being in an area which is dangerous or an area in which there's total destruction and disaster. There are a lot of people like this. Not a lot, meaning majority, but a substantial number. And sometimes you might begin to doubt yourself and think, that's what I am too. I'm just somebody who wanted to see crazy things. I don't want to commute to work and live out a life in America. I want to go and be somewhere dangerous and do these crazy things. So you doubt yourself and you think, I'm just a thrill seeker. I could be going to Six Flags Adventure. same morally equivalent endeavor.
Well, John Sifton, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us. I really wish you the best with your work in the future here and or abroad. And thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Terry.
John Sifton is a human rights attorney who spent the past year doing humanitarian aid work in Pakistan and Afghanistan. He wrote about Afghanistan in yesterday's New York Times Magazine. This is Fresh Air.